Well, we are in Revelation chapter 20. And we have rounded a big corner here in the book. There's only 22 chapters in Revelation. But as we enter into chapter 20, I have to give a bit of a disclaimer here, because this chapter is probably, it's definitely, in my opinion, the most debated chapter in the book of Revelation, if not the whole of Scripture. And so people's positions on this chapter have caused not only personal rifts, but you've seen churches divide over their positions on Revelation chapter 20. And because when you're in Revelation chapter 20, you are talking about the millennium. And so passions run high. And now the millennium is basically, if you're just new to this whole thing and you say, I don't know what that is, millennium is just basically the Latin word for 1,000 years. That's where we get the word from. And the millennium is 1,000 years is central in this passage, because all the events that are described in Revelation 20 either happen before the millennium, during the millennium, or after the millennium. And so it has this central place of kind of organizing what the events of chapter 20, of what's described there. And so now to get at where you land on Revelation 20, you basically, as Dennis Johnson writes his commentary, you've got to answer two key questions, two fundamental questions to land in a place where you say, this is, I know where I'm at in chapter 20, at least for the moment. And so the first question is, when is Jesus coming back? When is Jesus returning? Is he returning before the millennium, or is he returning after the millennium? Because how you answer that question is going to help you decide kind of what camp you're going to land in. Because if you believe that Jesus is going to return before the millennium, whatever the millennium is, whatever that looks like, if you think Jesus is going to return before the millennium, then you would be a premillennialist, because Jesus comes back premillennium, before the millennium. If you believe that Jesus is going to come back at the end of or after the millennium, then you would be a postmillennialist, because it comes after the millennium, or you would be an amillennialist. So that's the first question. When is Jesus going to come back? Is he going to come back before or after the millennium? That's the first question you got to answer. Second question you got to answer is, what conditions should we expect on earth during the millennium? What conditions should we expect on earth during the millennium? That's the second question that you have to answer. Should we expect a kind of a earthly kingdom in a semi-redeemed state for a lengthy period of time? Is that what we should expect? Should we expect a near universal acceptance of the gospel throughout the nation? Should we expect that? Or should we expect the world to look much as it does today? Those are the two questions you have to answer. Now, if all of that is a bunch of gobbledygook to you, then I've got good news. That's as much as I'm saying about it. You've got to answer those two questions, but if you want more information on premillennialism with its distinctive variations of dispensational, progressive dispensational, and historic premillennialism, if you want to know more about amillennialism or postmillennialism, then please this week go online to sermonaudio.com/BaileyPrez, or you can get to our audio archive also through baileychurch.com, our website, and get over to Sermon Audio. And there is a teaching series that we did during Sunday school. It's 6 parts. It's called Approaching Revelation. Approaching Revelation. And there we talked about the nature of the book of Revelation. We talked about interpreting prophecy. And we also went through each of those systems. Each of those systems of understanding of the book of Revelation and what that means. And so also there's handouts online if you want to download those. If you would like a copy of that because you don't get online for whatever reason, if you want a copy of that on a CD plus printouts of the handouts, then just let me know and I'll get it to you as fast as I can. But just let me know because it's online there. And so I'm pointing you that direction there for a couple of reasons. And I'm saying all this because, first of all, I do want to be just kind of lay my cards out on the table. For those of you who are familiar with those terms that I laid out there, I am coming from an amillennialist position. Now, what that position is will become clear over the coming weeks because we're actually going to spend some time in Revelation 20. And so what I'm going to preach is from that position. So I don't need to bullet point it this morning, at least not right now. And so, and the other reason, though, is because I want us to make sure that we intentionally avoid the potential pitfall that you get when you get into the book of Revelation. Because when I could spend just weeks detailing out, okay, this morning we're going to talk about premillennialism, next week we're going to talk about postmillennialism, next week, and we could just do that and go through that. But the problem is that I feel like I would be in violation of my duty to you as your pastor. Because my job on Sunday is not to be a great lecturer and disseminator of information. That is not my job. My job is to proclaim Christ with the faith and trust, and that God by His Spirit in the proclaimed Word would be transforming our hearts and minds. And so I'm not here to lecture you this morning on the finer points of Reformed eschatology. So all of that is just to say we're going to sidestep the big weed hazard. We're going to sidestep the weeds. We're going to sidestep the hazard that we would get stuck in. But I do want to give you the layout, the plan for what we're going to do. This morning, I'm going to give you an overview of Revelation chapter 20. We're going to hit at the major themes of Revelation chapter 20. And then we're going to take three more Sundays and go through the major sections. So verses 1 through 6, verses 7 through 10, and then verses 11 through 15. We're going to take a Sunday and look at each of those in greater detail. And so hopefully at the end of that, you'll understand it, but I want you to walk away today going, okay, I got a basic idea of what Revelation 20 is about. That's one of my goals today. And so that's what we're going to do, and that's my little disclaimer here. And so now I'm going to read the text from Revelation chapter 20. It's on page 1040 in the Pew Bible. Hear the word of the Lord. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. And he seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the pit, and shut it, and sealed it over him, so that he might not deceive the nations any longer, until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be released for a little while. Then I saw thrones, and seated on them were those to whom the authority to judge was committed. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus and for the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or its image and had not received its mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who shares in the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power. But they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they will reign with him for 1,000 years. And when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea. And they marched up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them, and the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Then I saw a great white throne and Him who was seated on it. From His presence, earth and sky fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Then another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the books, according to what they had done. And the sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, each one of them, according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found and written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. Thus ends the reading of God's holy word. Now, I can't understand why anybody would debate about any of that. You know, it's clear, it's crystal. I mean, we can just end the service. I just signed up for a service recently that provides you with book summaries of important Christian literature, both popular and scholarly level. And because there's so many books out there that even a bookhound like me can't keep up with them all. And so what this service does is it'll take roughly like a 300-page, you know, book, and it'll take it and they'll just kind of reduce it down. It's written by a scholar or a pastor or someone, and they'll just reduce it down to the central points that the author is making. And so it's because when you get into a big volume, it's really easy for us to you're reading and sometimes you just get distracted or you get lost or you just get disoriented and you're like, where am I in the book? I don't even remember what I read. I don't know where we're going. And you just kind of get lost. And life can be a bit like that as well. Because we live in a fallen world, and so life gets painful, it gets confusing, we can get disoriented, we can get lost in the midst of everything that's going on because we have so much that is happening around us before and after and even in the present. And so we can get in a bad way with how we think about the world and how we approach it, which is one of the reasons that the book of Revelation was written for the church. Because we can become overly involved in the world, accepting its values and really end up compromising our faith in Christ. We can also, another mistake we can make on the opposite end of it, is we can pull back. We can kind of form this, you know, not so tactical retreat deep into ourselves and our Christian communities, so much so that we actually are robbing ourselves of the good that God has for us to not only receive but also to do for the sake of His name. And so what Revelation 20 is, it's really a good book summary. It's a summary of the age in which we live, and then also what immediately transpires at the end of that age. And we might say that we could say that's, you know, true for the entire book of Revelation, but it's especially true of chapter 20. There's this just great distillation, this just kind of reduction that's going down and just saying these are essential things that you need to know about right now, and also important things you need to know about what's coming. And there's actually we're given four of them in Revelation chapter 20, which again nicely divide into two separate sections. And so what that means is that Revelation 20, first of all, is about the now. It's about the now. It's about the present time. We see this in verses 1 through 6. So this angel appears in verse 1, and maybe it was the same angel that showed up in verse 18 and 19. We don't know. We only know that he came from heaven. And he grabs Satan, he binds him with a chain, throws him in the abyss, and locks him up, essentially. And so this is what is known quite famously as the binding of Satan. And so to help us to understand what is going on here, we need to ask several questions. And one of them is what is the purpose, the stated purpose of locking Satan up? It is so that he may not deceive the nations any longer. And so this means that this is to stop Satan from doing something he was already doing, deceiving the nations. But once he's released at the end of the 1,000 years, he will resume that, but with a particular goal in mind. And so 20 verse 8 reveals to us Satan's ultimate aim, why he wants to deceive the nations. He wants to deceive the nations in order to gather them together to destroy the church. That's what he wants to do. That's the purpose of the deception. He wants to annihilate the people of God. And so what we can say then is that the specific purpose of the binding of Satan is to prevent Satan from utterly and completely destroying the church. That's the technical purpose of what's going on here. But when did this happen? Is this a future event? Is it a previous event? Well, we're going to go into this more detail next week. I'm going to give you a couple of verses from the New Testament. Matthew 12:29. Now this is Jesus. He was accused by the leaders, the Jewish leaders, that the way he was casting out demons was by the prince of demons. And he responds famously, No. A house divided itself can't stand. That doesn't make any sense to accuse me of that. It's not gonna make any sense. He said, rather, if you want to, and this is Matthew 12:29, how can someone enter a strong man's house and plunder his good unless he first binds the strong man? Same word used here in Revelation. Then he may plunder his house. And so Jesus is saying that essentially his casting out of demons is the beginning of this plundering of the house of the strong man. Why? Because Jesus has bound him. And also 2 Thessalonians 2:6-8. And actually even before that, in the Gospel of Luke, the disciples come back from after he had sent them out to go cast out demons and proclaim the good news of the kingdom. And they come back and they're casting out demons. And what Jesus says? He says, I saw Satan falling from heaven like lightning. Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 2:6-8. Paul writes, and you know what is restraining him now, so that he may be revealed in his time. Talking about the man of lawlessness. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains it, that is God, he who now restrains it will do so until he is out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord Jesus will kill with the breath of his mouth and bring to nothing by the appearance of his coming. It's interesting that when Jesus comes, He comes with a sword coming out of his mouth. You see this, there's this consistency about mouth, judgment with the Lord. But basically, just what you need to know from that passage, kind of takeaway there, is you see this divine restraint placed upon the devil and his representative, the man of lawlessness, who we would identify with the first beast, commonly called the Antichrist of chapter 13 of Revelation. And so what these passages and other passages in the New Testament, when you read them and you're studying them, what you can reasonably conclude is that the binding of Satan is actually a present reality. But that presents a problem, because people say, well, yeah, but how can you say that when there's so much evil in the world? How can you say that when Peter says in 1 Peter that the devil prowls around like a roaring lion, when Revelation says that he's all locked up? Is he not actively at work? Yes. But he is. But again, I mean, Peter's not actually saying that Satan is actually a lion. Any more than we expect literally there's this thing where you take Satan and lock him away in some kind of weird prison cell. It's giving a picture of something, a picture of a spiritual reality that is at work right now. And so what it's saying is that essentially Satan is able to, he's able to do things, but he is restrained in his activity. He can't do what he truly wants to do. He can deceive and he can even attack the church, but he's not able to gather the nations together to destroy the church. Now he's going to get that opportunity and later on in chapter 20, verse 8, but it's not going to go his way. And so, I just heard this illustration yesterday about this. It's kind of like a mob boss locked in a jail, who's able to continue through his minions to continue to do a lot of damage outside the prison, but he himself is restrained from freedom. Kind of that kind of a picture of. So the binding of Satan occurred at the first coming of Christ, when he showed up in his life. And especially his death. where he defeated Satan, where John says in 1 John he destroyed the works of the devil on the cross. The point is, and the negative point is that Satan is restrained. Why is he restrained? To what effect? That the gospel can go out to the nations. And one evidence of this is simply you here this morning saying, "I'm a Christian." Because what you have when you go through the Old Testament is you have the gospel promise that is given to a family line. It's given to Adam all the way in Genesis 3, and then it's passed on to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob and then on to the people of Israel. So you see this kind of line, it's just very narrow. This family, just one family, just narrow, it widens up, and finally the promise is for Israel, and it widens out a bit, but then there's the exile and it thins out again, and then there's a restoration, there's a little bit, and then all of a sudden, what happens? Jesus shows up. And then what happens to the people of God? Boom! Not just a little expansion, not just a explosion of the people of God. Well, what happened? Jesus came. And he died on the cross. And he bound Satan. So that way Satan cannot deter the message. The gospel is going forward. Now, one key thing that another pastor pointed out when he preached on this is that, remember, Satan's not the only source of evil in the world. Evil of man. Evil of my own heart. The fact that we live in a corrupt world and society, in addition to Satan and his minions. But the point is that Satan is restricted in what he can do. He's still active, he can still damage, but he cannot destroy the church and he cannot stop the gospel. He can't do it. And so the binding of Satan is actually about the spread of the gospel, and that is the first present reality of this age. The second present reality comes in verses 4 through 6, where we see that the dead saints reign with Christ. The dead saints reign with Christ. And so you see, John says, "Then I saw thrones," and presumably in heaven, near the very throne of God Himself. And so then we get this description of those who are sitting on that throne, and there's two key descriptors. The first one are those who have been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus, those who have been killed for the faith, that is, martyrs. And those who have been beheaded, that can't be literally just those who have been beheaded. This has got to include all of those who have died for the faith. And so we have martyrs. But then the second description is that whoever, not just martyrs, but whoever has not allied themselves with the beast, who has not worshipped the beast or his image or taken his mark. That is those. And so, who is this? Well, this, it, you know, what, well, what, is, what do these groups have in common? Well, they're all dead. They've all died. They don't have bodies. Remember, he says, "I saw the souls of those who had been killed. I saw the souls of those who had not worshipped the beast," sitting on these thrones. And so who is this? What is the picture of? It's the Christian dead. Revelation 14:13. "Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, and that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them." This is an important verse. This is one of the verses where we derive what happens to us when we die as believers now. But notice that even though they die, even though they're dead, even though they are disembodied souls in the present, they are with the Lord. They live and they reign with Christ even now. And so there's an assumption here that Christ reigns presently. We are not waiting for Christ to come and to take up His rule. We're waiting for His rule to be fully revealed and acknowledged by all of creation. And so we see this picture of what immediately awaits believers. You say, what happens when I as a Christian die in this life? That's what happens. That our soul is immediately brought into the presence of Christ. The word they used to use, we say transported, the old word they used to use not that long ago, but we don't use it anymore, is when we are translated to heaven. It's like you translate something from one language to another. So we are translated from this world to the next. We are translated into heaven. But we are immediately brought into the presence, and we're told this is the first resurrection. And you'll notice that in this passage there is a first resurrection and a second death, but you don't see them talk about a second resurrection or a first death. Not explicitly anyway, but the assumption is that they're there, or else why would they call it first and second? First resurrection. So there's two. And so we're going to get into, again, we're going to get into a lot more detail on this stuff in the coming weeks. But for now, what we can say is that the first death is physical death that everyone experiences. It has been appointed once for each man to die. And so the first death is the physical death that everyone experiences. But the first resurrection is that transportation of the soul of the believer to the very presence of God immediately upon death. And that is only experienced by believers. And we believe it's immediate, because what did Jesus tell the dying thief on the cross? Well, in 1,000 years, in a while, you'll be with me in paradise. No, he said today. Today you'll be with me in paradise. And we get a glimpse of that paradise. And the best news is that that's not even the actual coming paradise. That's what Randy Alcorn in his book on heaven calls the present heaven. That's the intermediate heaven. That's the temporary heaven. The eternal, what's eternal, what's truly coming, comes in the new heavens and the new earth. And so this is awesome, but that's not even the best part. And so all of this is happening now during the millennium. So I believe, along with others, that we are right now in the midst of the millennium. Revelation, with numbers in Revelation, are largely symbolic. Seven letters, seven churches, seven seals, seven trumpets, seven bowls of wrath, 42 months, 1260 days. We even see the number 4 is fairly symbolic, usually indicating the four corners of the earth, representing the whole of creation. And so the number 1,000 is symbolic as well. And we know that because we read the book of Psalms, Psalm 50:10. Lord owns cattle on 1,000 hills. Which hills are they? I want a map, geographically speaking. No, it's saying, no, if there's a cattle, if there's a hill, the Lord owns it. He owns it all. Psalm 84:10. A day in your courts is better than 1,000 elsewhere. But if you have 1,001 days, you know, in the Caribbean, I'll take that. No, it's saying one day in your course is better than any day anywhere else ever. Psalm 90:4, 1,000 years in your sight. We even incorporated this into a hymn, right? 1,000 years in your sight is like an evening gone. What it means is time is nothing to God, because He's eternal. Psalm 105:8 says He remembers His covenant forever for 1,000 generations, but only 1,000 generations, not 1,001. That's one too far. No, He remembers, it's equated with His remembering covenant forever is equated with 1,000 generations. And so the position that I'm working from understands the millennium to be symbolic for the period of time in between the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ. And it's very clear what happens during this time. I think I'm moving. I got ahead of myself. Because we're given two things: that believers, when they die, are present with Christ in heaven, and then we're also told that Satan is bound and not able to do what he really wants to do to us because of the power of the gospel, because of the power of Christ. And so Revelation chapter 20 is about now, but it's also about the not yet, about what is to come. We see that in verses 7 through 15. And so there are two major events that are going to occur at the end of the millennium, we're told. The first thing is that there's going to be a final battle, but not just final battle, because this is the third time we've heard about the final battle. The final battle is going to be a total rout. God is just going to dominate it. It's going to be over in a moment. At the end of the millennium, you know, coinciding with, leading right up to the very return of Christ, we should expect an incredible resurgence of evil as Satan is released to deceive the nations and to do what he really wants to do, to gather the nations to annihilate the church on the earth. And it's a massive army that can't even be counted, see on the seashore. We can't count the sand. How can you fight against an army like that? Well, you can't, but the Lord can. Fire comes down and burns up his enemies. And fire, as we've seen consistently, is a symbol of God's judgment. And we saw last week how Christ uses the sword from his mouth to slay his enemies. And here we have a picture of that in fire. And then the devil himself is thrown into the lake of fire, which is the same place where the beast and the false prophet were thrown at the end of chapter 19. And so the point is that all the enemies of God are going down. It's a common theme from chapter 19 all the way through chapter 20, is all the enemies of God and His people are done. And finally, they're all finished. They're all gone. I mean, after the devil's thrown in, and the battle's done, that's it. Once you get through Revelation 20, there's no more judgment. There's no more fights, no more wars, there's no more enemies. The Bible is filled with warnings of a coming day called the Day of the Lord. And in that day, that judgment's going to fall. It's going to fall right here, as we see in verses 7 through 10, and then also what we see in the next verses we'll talk about in just a second. But just don't get past the fact that the prince of the air, the father of lies, the representative head of all evil, will be judged finally and forever. I mean, there's just no more escaping, no more binding, no more releases, none of that. Don't you look forward to that? I mean, you look forward to that when that's gone, when you don't have to hear these horrific stories on the news about what people are doing to each other. When it's all gone. When the brokenness of the world is healed. It's coming. And that's the first thing that we need to remember. The second thing that we need to remember, this future reality that is coming, is the final judgment. Verses 11 through 15, famous passage, been preached on many, many times over the years. But suddenly this scene shifts over to this great white throne, and you see it as it appears, as it comes into view. The way it's coming into view is that creation is running away. I mean, it's just like creation's not even on trial, and it's like, I don't want to be here for this. I'm out of here. Creation's like, I'm out. And the defendants are presented to us, and we're told that they're simply the dead. Well, which dead? Well, all the dead. The great and the small, from the sea, from death, Hades, everyone, believer, unbeliever, is standing before the throne of judgment, and each one is judged according to his works. And it's very clear what happens when you get judged according to your works. For anyone who's judged according to his works, if we're judged by our deeds, by our lives, then that person is thrown into the lake of fire. Into what we call hell. Because they're found guilty of their rebellion against God. And this, we're told, is the second death. The second death is to be judged by God for our deeds and cast into the lake of fire, separated from Him forever and finally. And this is experienced only by unbelievers. Because we know that, because the only ones who are not judged according to their works are those whose names are found in the book of life. Notice that he doesn't say, and you know what, and because you know people who go to church are just really great people, and they did really good works, they're good. says, no, the only way you get out of that is not by your good works, but by your name being written in the book of life. So it is not by deeds that we escape judgment. It's not by our moral goodness. It's not by our church attendance. It's not by any of these things that we escape judgment. It is by whether or not our name is written in the book of life. That book of life that was written from the foundation of the world. And so this is a sobering reality for all humanity, that our deeds are going to be laid out before God. And unless our name is written in that book, the book of life, then we're lost. And so this presses us all the more to run to Jesus, to place our trust in Him rather than in ourselves, in this life, or anything the world can promise us. And so Revelation is about the now and it's about the not yet. These are incredible truths for us. But most fundamentally, we can say Revelation 20 is about God keeping a promise. And it's a promise that God didn't make to man. It's a promise that He made to the devil. And you could say God made a deal with the devil. Way back in Genesis 3, in the midst of the fall, while Adam and Eve are still doing the blame game, they're standing there in the mess and the shame of their sin, God looks over at Satan and says, "You deceived her. You incited rebellion in him. Think you won something? I'm going to put enmity between you and her, between your seed and her seed. I'm going to put hostility between you two, so that, you know what, when the end comes, you're going to bruise her descendant. You're going to bruise his heel, but he's going to bruise your head. He's going to crush you." Revelation 20. We see the offspring of the woman, the pure bride of the church, in opposition to the seed of the devil, the first beast, the Antichrist, the false prophet, whore of Babylon, and all their followers standing in the opposition to whichever. And what happens? Well, they bruise some heels. They bruise some heels. But in the end, Satan gets crushed. Revelation 20 is about answering the promise that God made all the way back in Genesis 3. And so the four things we need to know about the present life and the end is that Satan is bound while the gospel abounds. Those who die in the Lord reign with Christ in heaven now. And that one day God will destroy and judge all His and our enemies. And finally, that the final judgment is indeed coming, and our only hope is grace. And so as you think about your life and your struggles, I mean, consider the fact that Satan is bound. That he can't do to you what he really wants to do. That he's that and you know, does he still have influence? Yes. Does he still do damage? Yes. Does physical death still touch us? Yes. But because of Christ and His gospel, His saving grace cannot be stopped by either persecution nor circumstance. And so if your life just feels like you're just punching a brick wall and all you got to show for is bloody fists, then what the Scripture is telling us is then you need to latch onto the gospel, because that's going to punch through the whole that wall of darkness and sin and brokenness. And that's our hope. Let's pray.